Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Film Talk.
Hello, I'm Kevin Finn, your producer here, and we're here with another episode of Atlanta Film Talk, and I'm here with Krista Baruti, as we like to call her in the studio, KB.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
I'm doing good. What have you been up to?
It's
been a week.
I had a great weekend. Did a little Christmas partying. Went to the Originals cast and crew party with a friend over here, Dana Simmons.
Very nice.
Got
crazy, got a lot of blackmail.
Well, it's been, like 4 days, and I'm still recuperating, so it was a lot of fun.
Very nice.
Do you have a good weekend?
I had an absolutely great weekend. I did absolutely nothing for the first time ever. Moved into my new place in Castleberry, so
yeah.
I get to chill there.
Put up a Christmas tree?
Oh, yeah, we have a Christmas tree up, and
okay.
I chilled with the dog. The girlfriend went out and went shopping and everything, and I got to relax at home. So that was the first time I've done that in forever.
Excellent. Well, let's get started today. Thanks for tuning into your local film community. Kevin, would you like to introduce our lovely guests today?
If I have to butcher their names,
yes,
I will.
Yes, you have to, so
all
I don't
right.
butcher their names.
So here we go. We have Michael H. Harper. He's a screenwriter, producer, and director. He's the owner of Mad Mouth Media, and he's the co-owner and chief creative officer of Cogitate.
It's the hazing for the first guest. We have to do
thing.
It every time.
All right, and we also have Aaron Levine. Did I get that right? Did I already mess it up again?
She Levin. Told me
Levin.
Aaron
there
Levin.
We go. There we go. So with Imba Mean Sing, Peace Tree Productions. Did I get that right? Did I mess that up? Okay, great.
This is why it's a play on words.
And then we have Mike Malloy with Point Blank Pictures, LLC, and Subgenre Entertainment, LLC.
And the LLC could have been skipped.
It could have been skipped. No, I'm a professional. So, and then we have Dana Simmons, and he's a sound guy extraordinaire is what I've been told. So
like that title?
Well, that remains to be seen, but thanks.
All right, KB. Well,
it's heard. Not
yes. Yeah. There you go.
Who are we going to start with first today?
Let's start with Mr. Harper.
Oh, goody.
Hey, Michael. How are you doing today?
I'm wonderful, KB.
It's good to see you.
Do I get to call you KB now?
Heck yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's so people don't butcher my name. Krista Baruti, you should have heard what Kevin did to that the first time.
I'm a master at butchering names.
It was bad.
Well, the only thing about my name is the H, the middle H has to be in there.
It has to be.
It's in my contracts. I have to be credited as Michael H. Harper.
Well, I bet there's a lot of Michael Harpers out there, right?
There's a ton on IMDb.
What does H stand for?
None of your business.
Ooh. Yeah, no. Hellraiser. I've been on set with you before. I know exactly what it means.
That's right, yes.
So you have a lot of titles, screenwriter, producer, director. Which comes first?
Well, producing is what I've been doing mostly here recently, but that is, for me, that's 100% a job. If I could make a movie without actually producing it, I would.
You should hire me.
You know what? I actually have a list of producers that I've worked with in the past, and that list keeps growing, and I will definitely talk to you later because
That's what we're here for, exchange cards.
I'm pretty good at the parts of producing that I do, it's a grind, and I don't like doing it, but I do it so I can get my movies out there. Directing for me is 100% joy. I don't think I've got enough experience at it to consider myself proficient yet.
But do you get paid for it?
I do.
All right. Then
I do. and it's a lot of fun. It's something that I enjoy doing. I enjoy every minute that I'm directing. But for me, I consider myself a screenwriter first. That's how I got started in this business. And for me, it's the part of the process that really feeds me in a way that the other parts don't. And it's funny because it's kind of a balance between my hate of producing and my love of directing, you know, writing. There are several days a week that I sit down and I loathe being at that laptop,
right.
And I'm like, I have to write.
That's the war of art, right? That's what defines a professional and an amateur.
Yeah, you get up and you do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's absolutely nothing like, for me, there's absolutely nothing like the process of having written, not necessarily writing itself, but having written and being there at the genesis of a story and creating an entire world and populating it with characters. And, you know, it's the closest thing I'll ever get to heaven. So, I absolutely just adore it. So I consider myself a screenwriter who occasionally directs and reluctantly produces.
Right. Well, you know what stands out in my head when I was mentoring Drew and you spoke with him a little bit, and your first words of advice were, do not get into this industry. Don't. If you can do anything else, do it. Because, you know, it's glamorous on the outside, but God, is it a hustle and it's hard.
Well, I think a lot of people when they, you know, especially I meet people at parties. You talked about holiday parties. I was at a holiday party last weekend and met a couple of people. And, you know, the question, so what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a filmmaker. Oh, that must be so glamorous. And I'm like, yeah, no.
Only knew.
Right. The people, I think people assume that, you know, they pick up Entertainment Weekly or Us or whatever it is off of the newsstand, and they go, oh, look at the pretty dresses and the tuxedos and the red carpets. That's what it's like to be a filmmaker. And that just makes me laugh because that's, what, 0.1% of what we do? You know, so for me, and to be clear, I didn't, like, squash your poor kids' dreams, you know.
No, I think it was very valuable advice.
Yeah, it's not like I smacked him and said, don't do it. What I said was, if you can do anything else.
Smack him. Well, I'm just kidding.
I do. He got in my personal space. No, I told him, if there's anything else you can do and be fulfilled,
right,
do it, because it'll be an easier road to hoe than.
Right, and that's the key. Can you do anything else and not feel compelled?
Right, exactly.
To tell stories.
Yeah. And I've got a long and varied and checkered past doing all kinds of different jobs. And
you quit everything else.
I had to. But what's cool is they were all perfect training for me to become a screenwriter, because
absolutely,
I got lots of experience to draw from.
You still have to have the basic business skills. You know, you've got to be able to manage people. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, it all plays into it.
That's another thing about producing for me. I am not a diplomat. I don't see myself as diplomatic in any way, shape, or form. My idea of, you know, diplomacy is slamming a door or, you know,
yelling at people,
kicking somebody down the flight of stairs. That only happened once.
I went on set and met Michael on Morningside Monster, which some of you guys might remember from the last show. We had Chris Etheridge here. I was just there to observe with Dana, and I ended up needing a role so badly because I hate sitting still. I ended up cooking food for a crew of, what, like 20. And I have never had to cook food so quietly in my life, and so much food. So I was like tiptoeing, like upstairs, trying to cook this like big bat of pasta, and Michael yelling at me, quiet on set. I'm like, I'm a sound person. I get it.
We were filming in the basement, almost directly beneath you.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know,
were hungry.
We were very hungry, and we were grateful to get the food after we got the shot.
Yes, you know? Yes. Well, I'm glad that that much food turned
out. It's crazy what sound people hear.
Oh, yeah.
Dana can hear planes that are, like, in a different country.
Yeah, or, like, if you're sleeping at night, like, a needle drops, and you're like, ding.
Yeah. Well, the first time I worked with Dana, we were shooting, and he goes, we've got a plane. And I'm like, I don't, you know, I'm wearing cans. I'm like, I don't hear anything. And he goes, no, we have a plane, you know, I promise you. And I'm like,
we don't
have a plane.
Wait for it.
We're rolling. He goes, we have a plane. And so, you know, we get into the scene, and there's the plane. And I'm like,
and sound effect.
I'm like, how did you hear that? That was like over like Alabama at the time. He was like, yeah, no, it's fine.
So
I've learned to trust Dana. If he says
that's
we have a plane, there
sound
is a plane.
Guy,
there is a plane somewhere. So,
Michael, you have two companies, mm-hmm. Mad Mouth Media and
Cogitate Productions.
Cogitate Productions.
Yes.
So, Mad Mouth Media, you started in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell us a little bit about Mad Mouth Media.
Well, I started in the business. I quit my day job and started working in film full time in 2008. And I started out as the head writer at Blank Stage Productions in Marietta. And, I was there for about a year or so and had fun time. We did some good projects and met a lot of great people. But what I learned, what I came to learn while I was working at Blank Stage was it didn't make any difference how much input I had or, what I did as far as writing or helping to produce. I got into some assistant directing while I was there. It was always going to be a Blank Stage production. It wasn't going to, my voice was not going to be the predominant voice that was heard in those productions. And, as much as I enjoyed working at Blank Stage, I loved it. And, Brent Brooks, who runs it, is a great guy. But I wanted to kind of break out on my own a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so in 2010, I decided that I would produce and direct a short film that I had written called Take Me Out. And
I saw that.
Yep. And Dana was our sound person mm-hmm. for that, our location sound person, and did a fantastic job, even though I think he was 3.5 years old when we shot the thing. No, he did a fantastic job, and that's why we've worked together since then, because he came out and did such a great job on that. But, I made Take Me Out, and we shot it Thanksgiving-ish 2010, and it premiered in 2011 at the Action on Film Film Festival. And I did it so I could have my voice out there, so I could say, hey, this is a movie that I made. I'll say this, it was the best decision I ever made for my career because it really turned into a calling card piece.
To make a short film?
Yes, it turned into a calling card piece for me. And every job, and I mean this literally, every job that I've gotten in the business since then has been a direct it's like a snowballing effect. Mm-hmm. It's been a direct reflection of Take Me Out.
Well, and too, getting in there, getting your hands dirty and showing people, hey, I'm still learning right now, and that's fine. I admit to that, but I'm going to be a professional and I'm going to do this. Then people are going to call you back, And in short film, if there's money involved too, people will call you back.
Right. Yeah. That's definitely true. That's definitely true. And, the, one of the things that made Take Me Out such a success was I surrounded myself with good people. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing that I've learned being a producer is you're only as good as the team that sure. you assemble. My grandmother she was my favorite person on this planet while she was alive, and she still ranks up there pretty high. But she would tell me when I was a kid, Michael, you need to strive to be the dumbest person in the room. Mm-hmm. And, there's two ways you can take that. What she was trying to tell me was to surround myself with people who are better at their jobs than I am, so I can learn. Mm-hmm. I left Blank Stage and started working with a great production company, Cake Baby Productions, David and Kelly Silverman. And a shout out to David and Kelly right now because they're celebrating the birth of their first daughter, Evie.
Oh, everybody's having babies. Miss Jessica just had one. Heather and Ace just had their baby. So shout out to baby.
Yeah, babies.
Baby time.
End of the year babies too. So, but I learned so much working with David and Kelly. I watched them build Cake Baby Productions from the ground up and was lucky enough to be on, several of their shorts and in different capacities. And it really kind of taught me that, hey, you can start a production company. You can start your own production company.
You can do this.
Right. So, so I did it just to get my voice out there. And, so that was Mad Mouth Media. And I still love Mad Mouth Media. But then I started working with
Mr. Lee Walker.
With Mr. Lee Walker, yes. He came to me. And Cogitate Productions is actually an idea that Lee came to me with. I brought Lee on as an executive producer for Take Me Out. And then when I worked with Blue Dusk Productions, Chris Etheridge and Jason Palmer on The Morningside Monster, I brought Lee on as an executive producer for that as well. And we had a meeting one day, and Lee said, why are we, you know, let's start our own production company together.
Yeah, we need to cue that commercial again.
Yeah, and so we did. And, you know, I've known Lee for a decade. We've been really good friends for a really long time. And he started out, and, you know, bless his heart, what I wanted from him when we started working together was I wanted him to be my executive producer, which was basically sign the check and walk away.
Right.
Leave me alone. Give me money and leave me alone. And as we kept working together, he would come in, you know, some executive producers do this. I've got an idea. I've got an idea about the movie.
And you've got to listen to the idea because they have the money, right?
Exactly. But that's why I have in my contract that I get final cut, because then I can listen to whatever the executive producer says to me. And I can go, yeah, okay.
That's great. A great idea. Now
yeah,
have
but
some
it says
coffee.
So right here in the contract that I get to make the decisions. But he kept coming with really good decisions and good ideas. And so, and the thing about Lee is he loves movies the way I used to love movies before I got into this business.
Started working in the movie business.
Know? Yeah, and so he keeps my energy up, and he keeps me excited about the movies that we make together. And so, you know, he's really moved from just an executive producer into a true producer role. And once I can, you know, convince him that he really needs to take over the paperwork and he really needs to do
good
all
luck
the,
with that.
Yeah, that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. So we're going to have to hire Aaron.
No, you get Max.
Or you can let me borrow Lee. That would be even better.
No, he's mine. Yeah, no, no.
So tell us about 3 Minute Activist, this documentary that we just Tom just finished yesterday editing. I'm going to listen to the final cut today.
Excellent.
When he sends it to me.
That's fantastic.
Saving the good news for on air. Shout out to Tom.
Shout out to Tom. Tom has been fantastic working on,
Tom's amazing.
On 3 Minute Activist. 3 Minute Activist, The Soul of Slam is the documentary that Cogitate Productions is proud to put out in early 2014. It's our first feature. It's a documentary. And again, all props go to Lee because he brought me the idea. The city of Roswell celebrates Black History Month every year with their Roswell Roots Festival. And part of what they do at the Roswell Roots Festival is they have this fantastic spoken word poetry slam. This February is going to be the 10th annual Slammin' in the Suburbs Poetry Slam. And so last year, we were finishing up a large part of the shooting of Morningside Monster, and I had a lull in my schedule. I thought I had a lull in my schedule. And Lee came to me and said, hey, let's shoot a documentary about not just about the slam, you know, but let's get some of the higher profile poets together and interview them and let them talk. And, you know, it kind of morphed and worked. And I brought in one of my favorite producers, Gabrielle Pickle, who is, if I could hire her, but she's too expensive for me because she's too good at what she does. But I brought her on and we really worked out a fantastic schedule. We shot it all. Dana was the sound guy on that. And
shout out to Dana.
Dana, I don't know how many microphones he had, but he wired every square inch of the historic Roswell Cottage. And
why he's sound guy extraordinaire. Yeah.
And it sounds fantastic. But we got together and we sat these six poets down and fed them dinner and asked them a bunch of questions. And they had a fantastic discussion over dinner. And then we shot the poetry slam.
And wait, what was this location? The historic Roswell Cottage?
The historic Roswell Cottage. It's a fantastic location. It looks gorgeous on screen because it's one huge room. But it's all it's got polished concrete floors and exposed brick. But it's got these great black metal girders and stuff in the corners. It's just fantastic. It looks so good. We just pointed a camera and said, "Yeah, okay, just stand over there. That looks fantastic." So we shot there in February and had a great time. And most of the crew that I brought in, they weren't big poetry slam fans to begin with, you know, and they showed up because I had money and was paying them. And by the end of the night, I looked around and there were members of the crew. I'm not going to tell you who, Dana, openly weeping because
absolutely.
Yes. I actually did tear up a couple of times because spoken word poetry, it's a beautiful art form, and we didn't expect that going in. So the entire crew came out of it as real fans of the art form itself. And I'm proud to say that the documentary is turning out to actually be a good documentary. When we went in to shoot it, we were like, we don't know if we're going to get anything. You know, the poets might suck. The event might be a complete horrific thing. It might be like capturing a train wreck mm-hmm. on film. But everybody brought their A game. My crew, the poets, and we turned out. It turned out we have a really good documentary, and we're happy with it. We're proud of it. So we have a special screening, like I said.
Yes, tell us when the special screening is.
Roswell, as part of their Roswell Roots Black History Month celebration, the entire month of February, Roswell has all kinds of fun stuff going on. And so February 20th at 7 p.m. is the 10th annual Poetry Slam. But a week prior to that, on February 12th at 7:30 p.m. at the Aurora Cineplex, mm-hmm. we are having a free screening of 3-Minute Activists, The Soul of Slam, to kind of give back to the city of Roswell. Everybody is invited. Like I said, it's a free screening. We're going to have some of the poets there. I'll be there. We'll be doing a Q&A afterwards. We'll have posters and T-shirts to give out and that kind of stuff. And it's really just an opportunity to give the people of Roswell a chance to see the movie before we start, you know, moving out into distribution and that kind of stuff.
Excellent. So. Well, I will be in touch with you later today to send you hopefully the master print of the sound.
That sounds fantastic. Woo! I am excited because it looks good. So good. I'm ready for it to sound as good as it looks.
You've got an awesome sound team.
We do.
Dana did a great job. Gave Tom great stuff to work with.
Now what's Dana's placement? Title again?
Sound guy extraordinaire.
Oh, right.
Yes. That's what it says in the credits too.
Yeah.
I hope so.
It's in his contract.
Yeah.
So you like to stay busy. What's next, Michael?
Well, let's see. Cogitate, we have 4 different scripts in early script development right now, which is nice, and they're all features. And so I'm still plugging away at that.
Goodness.
Yeah.
That alone sounds like a busy plate.
It's a full plate. And, you know, Morningside Monster premieres January 14th, and... So the guys at Blue Dusk have started talking about, hey, what's next? And they've been nice enough to invite me to discuss with them, hey, what's next? So that's something I'm working on. Literally just this past Saturday, the 14th, I sent in the first draft of a psychological thriller I'm writing for a production company out in L.A. called Perennial Imprint. I'm working with producers Raquel Scott and producer-director Tosin Coker. And it's an awesome, just really cool...
You're really excited about
I'm
that.
I'm very excited about that. Times, yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Feature, psychological thriller, and even though the production company is in L.A., they're discussing the possibility of bringing the production itself to Atlanta in 2014. It will more than... qualify for the tax incentives, which mm-hmm. is nice. So I'm hoping that will be brought here, and whether it's brought here or not, it'll be shot sometime in 2014. So,
great.
So yeah,
well, you've got part of your new crew here with you today. Huh?
Yeah, that's one reason. You know, that's one reason I've pitched to the producers. Hey, bring it to Atlanta. Bring it to Atlanta.
It'd be funny to go from African children's choir to
what a contrast.
Crazy thriller,
psychological
out.
Thriller. Yeah, why not? You know, so
well,
yeah. So
great.
I'll stay busy.
Diversity.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Thank you for joining us. You're going to stick around and chat with some more guests with us?
Yes, definitely. Thank you for having me. I do appreciate the invitation.
Yes. Tell our listeners how they can get in contact with you and stay in touch with the 80,000 things you have going on.
Well, Madmouth Media, we have www.madmouthmedia.com. We have cogitateproductions.com. I have michaelhharper.com.
Michael H. Harper.com.
And those websites suck. There's nothing there. So if you really want to get in touch with me, Mad Mouth Media is on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/madmouthmedia.
Excellent.
If you're a tweeter or a Twitterer, I don't know the proper term
for that.
I'm not
sure either.
I'm at Michael2H on Twitter. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stick around. We're going to move right on to mic number two. Mr. Mike Malloy, how are you doing today?
Meh.
Well, thanks for giving me something to work with there.
They don't want to hear inane chatter.
So tell us about Point Blank Pictures.
Point Blank Pictures is an LLC that I just formed with some people in various other parts to produce the official sequel, the third and final official sequel to Django. Django was a film that, by the way, this is terribly out of order.
I'm trying to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, but a different setup would have told my story.
Michael, Mike, you're fired.
I will take 100% reduction in pay for this.
Okay.
I met Franco Nero. He's an Italian actor, a legendary Italian actor. I met him on a documentary I made, and I'd also produced a Western. And so in having met him and having produced a Western before, the opportunity once Django. Django has had 40-year just household name status in all the world except for America, and that changed last December. Tarantino made a film which borrowed the Django name. He gave a cameo to the original Django, Franco Nero, and finally America, the Django brand has finally penetrated America. So with that, we turned to Franco Nero, my buddy and I, Eric Zaldivar and I, we pitched him on an idea, Franco Nero is just like the Clint Eastwood of Europe. He's the Clint Eastwood of the third world. He's just this god all the world over. He had no reason to listen to us, but he liked our story idea. We wrote a script. We got a veteran producer attached and stuff. And so now we have, and after a year-long sequel rights hassle with the Italians, we now are moving forward with Django Lives. And we have a bunch of great Hollywood cast and crew attached to make sure that this is not seen as like a European thing or a cult thing or anything like that, but is viewed as a mainstream product. We have Wes Anderson's DP, Robert Yeoman, set to shoot. We have Tarantino's editor, Joe D'Agostino, set to direct. We have a great cast. The only few can I announce so far. We have Mark Boone Jr. from Sons of Anarchy, Noah Segan from Looper, people like that, and of course, Franco Nero, Signora Nero, the original Django. There's been about 50 Django movies made, and he's only played the role twice so far. This will be his third and final official Django film.
Excellent. Yeah,
that is the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm a huge Django fan, original Django fan, so big props for that. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Would you like your proper setup now?
Oh, no. It's all blown at this point.
Okay, so you're an author, journalist, film critic. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Oh, yeah. At age 19. Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's what I was expecting to lead with. At age 19, I got my first book contract to write the biography of Lee Van Cleef. He was a spaghetti Western tough guy actor. He was the bad and the good, the bad and the ugly. I was just a college kid in Alabama. I went down to the college library. I plucked a couple of film books off the shelf. I copied down the addresses of the publishers, and I sent off two query letters. One came back no, but it was addressed to Dear Professor Malloy, and the other one came back a yes. And so I wrote, as a 19-year-old, I had really no business writing a book at 19. Your frontal lobe isn't even developed, but you know, Stephen Crane, notwithstanding, Red Badge of Courage, 19-year-olds shouldn't really be writing books. But I did it, and it got published, and it's in its third edition now. So that was the beginning of my career as a film journalist and a cinema book author and stuff. And I moved out to L.A., and I wrote for a bunch of big movie magazines and stuff. And then I moved to Atlanta, become the film critic for the Sunday paper here, start getting in bigger publications, Slate.com, Flaunt Magazine, stuff like that. I was just about to the point where I was about to piece together a living and just barely scrape by. And all of a sudden, the whole world decided to convene one night, overnight. I was asleep. They didn't invite me. But the whole world decided that they were going to vote and decide that film journalism was going to become a non-paying profession.
Oh.
So I woke up and the bottom had just dropped out. You know, Chicago Tribune axed like a third of their staff, and LA Times, and, you know, Atlanta Journal-Constitution and stuff. So all of a sudden, the freelance gigs I did, I was, you know, the editors I was pitching, they used to buy my stuff. Now they don't even get back to me because my competition overnight has, like, just increased 8,000%. So that kind of pushed me on to back into filmmaking. But, you know, having a decade plus of film journalism under my belt kind of informs my filmmaking. I'm kind of the bad guy of cinema because I'm out there telling, if I'm at a party, I'm telling people, yeah, don't get into filmmaking just for a purely mercenary reason. There's too many films being made. We're cutting each other's throats. Nobody can sell anything. Nobody can get an advance. Nobody can get an MG. We need to make fewer, better films. But the good news about, I think, my film journalism background is that I kind of have a good sense for what's out there, what's been done in the 100-plus years of cinema. And we need to stop making the same stories over and over, because at this point it just feels like we're updating the haircuts, you know?
Sure.
That's all we're doing. So,
or, you know, adding monsters to them.
Well, adding... No, it may be the same monsters, just rendered in different effects. No more rubber suits.
Yeah,
but and I prefer rubber suits. But, no, like, I did this... I produced that Western, The Scarlet Worm, and it's like a prerequisite. If I sign on to a project, I want to do something that adds to the body of cinema. So it was the world's first abortion Western. So...
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, you all done there? You just took a little break.
That's a mic drop. That's a mic drop moment.
Yeah.
He just said abortion Western. just walk
crickets,
away.
Crickets. So, tell us a little bit about Eurocrime, which I don't know if I'm allowed to say. I get to watch later.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to go watch that because it's not released yet, correct?
Yeah, it's doing theatrical one-offs right now.
But you can just hand over a copy to me.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or maybe you just want a good company to watch it again. I'm pretty cool to watch a movie with.
Yeah, a 2-hour documentary. I don't care if I ever see that thing ever again in my life. No, so I was, you know, my career as a film journalist was winding down. I decided to parlay whatever knowledge I had about cinema into a cinema documentary. I had a book contract at the time to write Movie Tough Guys of the 70s. It was a 4-year book contract. I was 2 years in, 2 years worth of research and writing. And our house gets burglarized, and they boosted my laptop and my backup drive. So I lost 2 years worth of research and writing in 30 seconds because some crackhead had the sweats and the shakes, I guess. But, you know, that kind of pushed. I'm sure those thugs thought that they were doing me a favor. They're like, this guy needs to make a clean break from print media. So let's just push him on.
Just going to take his entire life away from him.
So while researching this 70s Tough Guy encyclopedia, I was, just these Italian-made films from the 70s. Here's what happens. You know, the Italians are very fat-oriented. They did the spaghetti Western. They didn't have TV to speak of, so they went to the cinema like 4 and 5 times a week. They made movies like we make TV over here back then, just cheap, fast, crank it out. So they made, like, you know, 500-plus spaghetti Westerns. And then when the spaghetti Western fad ended, they looked to cop films like Dirty Harry, and they looked to gangster films like The Godfather, and they just took the ball and ran with that from, like, 1973 to 1980. They made hundreds and hundreds of these cop and gangster films over there. And, kind of interesting them reinterpreting organized crime through The Godfather, because that was a big issue for them, and red terrorism was a big issue for them. Italy was a very violent place in the 70s. But, on the surface, these look like Dirty Harry and Godfather ripoffs, when in fact they're addressing a lot of their own big issues.
So you have made another documentary as well, Plastic Movies Rewound.
I'm in production on that. Mm-hmm. It's something I've been wanting to do for years.
I'm really excited about that one.
Oh, good. Yeah, so Eurocrime took a lot longer than I wanted. And
how long did it take?
4 years. And Plastic Movies Rewound, the story of the 80s home video boom, is in production now, and it's got two competitors. In fact, it did have two competitors because those movies have already been completed, have been on the festival circuit, and are now being distributed. So I don't even have the competition anymore. I'm way, way behind. But the good news is that those kind of took like a kind of nostalgic approach to VHS and the video boom and the mom and pop video store, and they kind of almost took like this hipster ironic approach to, oh man, VHS is so cool. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that tack at all. For me, it's the 80s was like this wild west, lawless frontier of the entertainment industry. And a lot of people got rich, but a lot of people got ripped off. And I always kind of gravitate towards like the harder edge, you know, side of any subject matter. So that's my take on the 80s home video boom.
That's interesting. What's your projected deadline for Plastic Movies Rewound?
All bets
sooner
are
than
off.
Later.
All bets are off. We just shot another. It's also when you tell people and when you're striving to tell a story definitively, it's very hard to cut yourself off as far as shooting interviews and production. You know, like this is a big, big story, and so it's going to be a six half hour episodes, and I still have more people I want to interview.
Well, excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to watching Eurocrime later today. It's going to be real fun, and you guys can join us if you'd like.
I just gave her a thumbs up on the radio. That really doesn't work here, does it?
We need a thumbs up sound effect, Kevin. Can we do that?
I'll work on that.
Just do the whoop.
Okay. Maybe if you can get the guys with the money to throw me that way. So the decision makers.
They're hiding in the
or
corner.
What was his name? Jay? Lynn?
Lee.
Yeah, we'll call Lee.
We'll call Lee.
We'll bring Lee next time.
Who is this Lee person?
My executive producer.
Oh.
Where were you earlier?
He threw a lot of names. He was every bit as verbose as I was.
Probably more so.
So, Mr. Mike Malloy, tell people how they can reach you and stay in touch with what you've got going on.
Oh, well, like him, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I don't care about building websites. So, yeah, I threw stuff up
Facebook.
On Facebook. Yeah, exactly. Facebook.com, Django Lives Movie. Facebook.com/Eurocrime, Facebook.com/PlasticMoviesRewound.
Are you a tweeter?
No. I'm a filmmaker. Wow. No, I don't even admit that in public generally.
I have to start tweeting. I haven't tweeted since 2009. But, well, thank you for joining us, Mike. You want to stick around for the rest of our guests?
That's appropriate, isn't it?
You are so much fun
you
to interview.
You should be a comedian. You are so funny. All of you listening who think I don't have a sense of humor, I have learned one today.
Aw.
Because of you.
Thanks for contributing, Mr. Malloy.
A fan of one.
All right, moving right along. And I'm going to kind of introduce Dana and Aaron sort of at the same time. Let's give a little bit of background on Mr. Dana Simmons, sound guy extraordinaire.
Sound effect. So,
yeah. I know. I'm going to require that from every sound person that comes on now. They have bring your own sound effect. Bring your stinger. So Dana, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I record sound. Which
wow, you guys are amazing.
which sounds sort of boring, but you know, the places that it's taken me has been really amazing. I've had the pleasure of working with Aaron and working with Michael on their projects, and the stories that I've been able to help tell is just you know, it doesn't feel like one person should be able to do that.
Well, and it's, you know, it's a totally different way of telling a story. It's the way that you perceive it, and sound people, it's like what we were talking about before we went on air, you know. We can hear a plane coming from, you know, 3 hours before it's coming. So it's just telling a story differently, correct?
Sure, yeah. Well, and, you know, it's really easy to get caught up in all the technical details of movie making and stuff. But it's really about the people and, you know, being able to interact with them in a natural way, especially in documentary filmmaking. For me, it's about being able to be natural with the people around you and capture those moments that you know, if somebody's just a little bit uncomfortable, they're not going to open up to you at all. Mm-hmm. And so having that open rapport with your subjects is a really important part of filmmaking, I think. And that's tricky sometimes.
You've been working on a lot of documentaries.
It's really tricky. I've really fallen in love with documentaries.
You think you're going to stick with that? I mean, you work on big productions, too. You're working on the originals right now.
Film business is such a tricky thing. If I had my pick and choice of what I could make a living doing, then yeah. But as we've
comes down to the money.
Well, unfortunately, sometimes it does. As far as what you have to do to support yourself. Mm-hmm. But I there will always be a special place in my heart for documentary filmmaking, and I only wish that I can be as fortunate in the future as I have been this year to work on these projects.
You've worked on some really cool stuff, and you've told me about this recent project with Miss Erin Levin. Hello, Erin. Yes.
And Erin,
hey, y'all.
Yeah, I'm.
Hey, y'all.
Erin's.
She's bringing the South.
Do so much better justice talking about the art of documentary filmmaking.
Well, feel free to chime in. Erin, tell us a little bit about this project that you're working on. Imba means sing. Did I say that correctly?
You said it just like the kids. Oh. I say it wrong. I say Imba, but they say Imba.
Imba.
Imba means sing. Imba means sing in Luganda and Swahili, which are two of the languages that many of the kids in the African Children's Choir speak. And a couple weeks ago, we just got home from Uganda and wrapped 2 years of principal photography. Oh. So,
congratulations.
Thank you. All day, every day for 2 years.
I think that's a rap song, isn't it? I kind of wanted to go into it.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
We should have a sound effect for rapping 2 years of principal photography.
Next I'm giving you a radio thumbs effects. Up.
Thanks. yeah, it's really, really exciting. We are starting edit. And the first thing in the new year, and we hope the film will be ready in August or September of 2014. It's a feature independent documentary social impact film. It's a nonprofit film, so it's an indie film. We're not actually really associated with the African Children's Choir, but because we want it to get shown everywhere and not be biased, which is how I assembled my team, since I was biased and I wanted to bring in people that weren't. And we're donating 100% of profits from the film to the choir's education work on the ground in 7 countries across Africa.
Wow, that's great.
Very cool.
That's very cool. It's really exciting. So it's kind of a long story how I met the choir, but
we've got time.
Tell
us all about it.
I could spend the whole hour and a half talking about these kids. I just love them and really believe in them, and they changed my life. And so I'm excited for the film to hopefully get to open millions of more people's eyes and hearts and change their perception of Africa. So I met the kids.
I just want to hug you.
virtual, or we're sitting next to each other.
We're hugging. Carry on. So it's a girl thing.
It's Christmas time.
Yeah.
So I'll make you cry. That's my mission in life, is making people cry.
Hopefully by not by hugging too hard.
So I met the kids the summer I graduated from college from the University of Virginia in 2007. I was working for a rock band called Dispatch. They're the number one selling indie rock band.
I love Dispatch.
Yeah, says the radio guy. they actually became famous because of Napster and testified on behalf of Napster to Congress.
Really?
Yeah, really cool.
We could go into this for another hour.
They have films. You should get them to come next time they're in Atlanta. But anyways, they are all really passionate, these three guys, and talented artists about Africa. And they had broken up as a band and realized that together they could raise a lot more money than separate for Africa, and specifically for what at the time was going on in Zimbabwe. So they brought me on to kind of help with this huge event at Madison Square Garden. It sold out in a few minutes, 3 nights there, wow. And all the money was going to help really cool, like, grassroots efforts in Zimbabwe. And we wanted to bring some Zimbabwean kids over to sing with them, and it was really tough. So this other group had just been nominated for a Grammy, and they were called the African Children's Choir. So we brought them over, and I met these kids, and it was a pivotal time in my life, like graduating college. I was actually about to move to Africa to be in the Peace Corps as soon as we finished these concerts, and you know, graduating from college is hard.
It's like so exciting.
Learning is hard.
It's just hard. Yeah, you just are like lost, and these kids found me. Mm-hmm. You know, they like met me where I was and loved me and just really flipped my world upside down and my perspective. And the kids that I met in that choir, it was choir 28, they were mostly all orphans, and they were from Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda. And their families had died of HIV, AIDS, malaria, the genocide. Wow. These were like the youngest of the genocide kids in Rwanda. But they were the most joyful kids and people I had met in my entire life. And here I had this really privileged life in Atlanta and, you know, had traveled all over. And never had I met someone that just their smile just glowed of just peace and joy and love and all these things that I just craved. So I decided, oh, my God, I'm a storyteller. That's what I'd always wanted to be, a journalist. I've got to tell their story, but I didn't have time. I moved to Madagascar. I was in the Peace Corps. We got evacuated.
Listen, that's great. I came. You've done everything.
He's done everything. No, I'm like nothing compared to
They should make a movie about your life. There we go.
And yeah. Not yet.
Collaboration.
I love how she said not yet.
Not yet.
It's like it's on the horizon.
Let me
but
rule
not
the
yet.
World and then you can make a movie.
When Angel becomes president, which I'll get to, then you can make a movie about me and Angel. But in the meantime, I came home, worked at CNN for 3 years, loved it, learned so much. I thought I knew how to write, but my mentors there really taught me how to write in a way that effectively communicated instead of just like shared all my thoughts and feelings and ideas and passions. I took a vacation from CNN. Like I took a month off. They're really nice about time off, and went with one of my friends to make a video for her website for her nonprofit in Uganda. And I had not forgotten about the African Children's Choir, but it had been like 3 years since I saw them, and I just was swept up in life. Mm-hmm. And working really hard on covering politics, and that's what I studied. And so we got to Uganda, and our first day there, literally, I ran into the African Children's Choir.
Wow!
Yeah, so pretty awesome.
Just by chance?
Yeah.
That means it was meant to be.
Yep. So I ended up spending half the time with my friend and half the time with the choir, brought all this footage back to CNN, raised some money at a wedding, actually, that I went to, like, that weekend that I got home so that I could go back out. Got CNN to, like, let me go and travel all over with the kids on my own, me shooting it. I had really no idea how to shoot. And I had, like, a $3,000 camera, not anything fancy. And brought it back, wrote a script. It was my first script that was more than a minute and a half long. It was 30 minutes, and they gave me an editor, and we put together a 30-minute documentary on the choir. So that was in 2010, and I was so excited, and the documentary was really successful. It aired on CNN International, and I asked if I could, like, take that and just, like, go to colleges and get millions of young people like me involved and just, like, really change the world. And they wanted me, which was my job, to go back to covering news and politics, and I just couldn't after I got
after
the bug.
Yeah. Like,
and I knew that if, like, I had done all this, if I hired people that really knew how to do it well, that millions of people could see it, and millions of people's lives could be changed because of these kids. So I quit, and I started raising money. And here we are, 2 years later, and we finished shooting, and it's really a miracle. But we still have a long way to go.
Well, you've come a long way, though, and, you know, just keep at it. Tell us a little bit about your travels. I was talking to Dana about it. It sounds like an amazing trip, and I still haven't seen pictures or footage.
It was my first trip to Africa, but Aaron's no stranger to that part of the world.
You've been, like, everywhere, though, haven't you?
It was my 14th trip to Africa.
Wow. I still can't get over the fact that you just ran into them. When you went to Uganda.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's not like Africa is a small place.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know.
Even Uganda. Hey. I mean, yeah, it really is meant to be, and it's exciting to get to live that out through film. And the story isn't what I expected it to be either. Like, basically, in a nutshell, the choir takes kids that are either orphans or just extremely vulnerable and can't even afford to go to the first grade in these seven countries across Africa. And they train them in music, drumming, and dance.
and educate them. And then they tour the world for from a year to 2 years, all over the world, like everywhere. You know, like there's choirs that go to Japan, Australia, all over Europe, the U.S., Canada, Jamaica. And then they raise enough money on tour to pay for their education through college. So the choir's 30th anniversary is next year when the film comes out, which is also kind of ironic and awesome. And former choir kids that are my age in their 20s are human rights attorneys, HIV/AIDS doctors, TV news anchors. Like the head TV news anchor in Kenya is a year younger than I am and was an abandoned little boy in Kenya. And he's there because of the choir, you know. But it's not even about the choir. Like, it really is following the journey of three of the kids, Moses, Angel, and Nina. Dana got to know really well.
Tell us about Angel. You said something about Angel becoming president.
So Angel wants to be the first female president of Uganda, and I really think she can be. Do you want to talk about Angel a little?
Yeah, Angel's an incredible kid as far as being able to, you know, work with other kids to accomplish a comic, you know. And while all the kids are absolutely amazing in their own ways, Angel and her ambition is really something to behold. And I'm absolutely positive it's going to come across in the documentary. So you just have to watch it because I'm not doing it justice describing all these kids.
Now we're calling Angel a kid. What age?
She's nine.
Nine.
Wow. So she's a kid.
Uh huh.
Wow.
Tell them about her stutter, though. You know that more than I do.
Sure. You know, Angel has these moments of brilliance when she's amongst her peers and friends, but has a real difficult time expressing herself in a formal way. Mm-hmm. And so to see her ambition of becoming a president is really sort of amazing, you know, to imagine the hurdles that she'll have to overcome, not only the social hurdles, but also the personal things that she's going to have to overcome.
So it's going to be a sequel to The King's Speech.
Right.
Wow. So tell us about the other two kids and how old are they?
So Moses is now 10 and Nina's also 10, though. I don't believe her because I think she looks like she's 14. She's just, like, gorgeous.
Starting early about my
age. And Moses wants to be a pilot, and Nina wants to be a pediatrician. Nina's situation at home, I think, was one of the hardest things for the crew, so I'll let Dana talk about that, too, because it's not like I'm jaded, but I'm just used to it and comfortable in where they live, but I think it'll shock the viewer in a way that Dana can explain better than I can.
Definitely. Well, like I might have mentioned earlier, it was my first trip to Africa, any part of Africa, and Uganda especially. So going there for the first time was visually very shocking. And as we got to know the people we were staying with, it was also, you know, very much a cultural shock as well. So we got the opportunity to follow these several of these kids to their to where they live. This was their first time going home in 18 months. They'd been on the road traveling the world, and we were there to capture the moments of them going home for the first time in that period. And that was just really amazing. We were really concerned about how the kids were going to handle being home for the first time, because they had seen the world, and here they were in these less than, you know, Western conditions. And we were really concerned about how they were going to take it. But the kids were just so excited to be amongst their friends and amongst their family again. And I think that really speaks to the human condition. Mm-hmm. of how adept these kids are at adapting to the world.
Mm-hmm. And their resilience.
Right.
I mean, the film, to me, the reason I wanted to make it was just to show the world these kids and their and talk about the education. Like, they can't get an education, and look at what they do when they can. But it's turned into, over the past 2 years, a story of what does it really take to be happy? Mm-hmm. You know, these kids have been into Disney World and in, like, famous music producers' mansions in Nashville and just done these crazy things that most Americans don't even get to do. And then we go back to Nina's home, which doesn't have electricity, doesn't have running water. There's not even any latrines in her slum. So they, like, literally go to the bathroom in paper and throw it. It's one of the saddest places that you can ever see. But being there is incredibly happy. The kids just, like, dance and giggle and teach you Luganda, their language, or their tribal languages. And just want to play with you and learn from you and tell you all the English that they've learned.
Wow.
It's really magical. So the film, and another thing, like Mike was talking about how we're telling the same story over and over and over again through film and maybe even through documentary. And one of the things that I think makes Imba Mean Sing so special is there's no white people really in the film. There's not really any grown-ups in the film. So that's why I keep watching Beast of the Southern Wild, because this is the real version of that. Like, mm-hmm. this is 3, 7, 8, 9-year-olds from the beginning, kids telling their story and showing the West to Americans, showing Ireland to Irish people, like their perspective, and showing their Africa, which is really hopeful. These kids are not ashamed of where they come from. They're proud.
That's beautiful. So what are your hopes for this film, your overall hopes when it comes out in August? Yes,
August, September-ish.
It's a plan.
Yeah, as soon as possible. We still have a lot of money to raise. So I've raised $235,000. And
how can people help with that?
$212,000 left to raise. Every donation is tax deductible. So if you want to donate, even a dollar really helps. I raise $100,000 in small, like, donations under $10 from friends. So really just go to our website, imbafilm.com, and just give what you can, especially in the holidays. I think it makes a really special gift to someone. Instead of giving them a pair of $10 socks from J. Crew, give them a $10 donation and we'll give you a really great photo that you can stick in their stocking. And a story to tell in their honor. So that's really helpful. We're also taking investors. So, you know, we have an LLC and a nonprofit. The nonprofit that we go through is our fiscal sponsor, the Creative Visions Foundation, which is an amazing organization that helps social impact filmmakers like me get to actually make our dreams come true, because a lot of young filmmakers you see are independently wealthy, and those of us that aren't, it's hard. But there's starting to be money out there for people like us. So give it to me, please.
Give me your money. So you'll raise the money.
And then, like, and then Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, people really care about that. So it's at imba_film and facebook.com/accfilm. They won't let you change your name once you have 200 fans. So we didn't have a name yet when I started the page.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And
we're learning stuff today.
Yeah. You guys always need social media. Yeah. Ask me. God, I like learn stuff from the kids every day too. It's crazy. But what did you ask?
Oh, your your hopes for the film. So you raised the money.
I mean, we're gonna do. I really want to go to tons of film festivals. I want to kind of copy a lot of the way that Girl Rising. They weren't exactly a documentary, but I think their outreach and Half the Sky's outreach was really incredible, and I'd love to follow in their footsteps with Gather and different theatrical things like that. I really want to do a college tour. So any of you future filmmakers listening, if you're in college, we'd love to come talk to you. Our director.
But then you got to promise not to get into film.
Right.
unless you have to.
For good cause. For yeah. good cause.
No, we kind of need less of us, too. I mean, it's saturated. unless you have no other choice, which I think all of us at this table just had no other choice but to do it. There's like a fire that's inside of you. You know, if you don't have that fire, don't do it.
So if you can't escape the fire and get out of yourself, then do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, because you'll quit everything else.
Right.
That's just how it happens.
Like CNN, which is insane. In 2009, when the economy had crashed, I quit my job. I mean, stupid.
Because I have a fire inside.
2011.
I have three cavities that have needed to be filled for a couple of years now. And I, you know, kept putting it off. And I went in for my teeth cleaning this time. And he's like, yeah, it's about tooth yanking time on those. So, yeah, such is the life of
That's the fire inside a cavity.
Yeah, you don't get paid much.
So, good thing you guys are seeing me now, mouth intact.
I'm glad you have a mouth.
Yeah. Your listeners, not so much.
So, tell us again how people can reach out and help you with Imba Means Sing.
So, imbafilm.com, imbafilm.com, and Facebook and Twitter and just encouragement and just telling all of your friends about it is
it really goes a long way. Right now, I don't know if I can talk about wine on the radio.
No FCC guidelines. Okay.
Next time, you bring it.
right now, until December 23rd, there's a really cool social enterprise called Cultivate Wines in Santa Barbara, California. And they are donating $1 to us for every single Facebook tweet or Instagram of a certain picture. So if you go to @IMBA_film on Twitter, then you can get the picture. And if you just retweet my tweet once a day, then you can get us a lot of money. Wow. We've raised like almost $2,000 through it this month so far.
Cool.
Excellent. Well, like I said, next time bring some wine too.
I will.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us. Did you guys have a good time today?
I did. Well, how do people reach out for you, Dana? How do people hire you, Dana?
Yeah. Watch Anchorman, too.
I kind of skipped over Dana. I'm so used to seeing you every day.
It's one of the perks of the job to get to listen to you people that are in the room with me right now to speak. That's one of my favorite things is to kind of hear other people's story. So I'm just really glad to get to hear Aaron and Michael and Mike talk about their projects.
And Dana did the sound, helped on the sound for Anchorman, too.
Yeah, cool. Dana's done a lot of stuff. He hates bragging about himself, though.
And that's in theaters, opening in theaters
in
tonight.
We actually have one of that. Yeah. We have one of the actors
opening tonight. So.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Who?
I forgot his name. He's like very small-time partner.
Will something, yeah.
Somebody.
Somebody.
Well, thank you guys for joining us, and special thanks to our sponsor, Indie Film Series, presented by Afterlight Pictures. Indie Film Series is a monthly event premiering independent films at Aurora Cineplex. Next showing is a couple days before your premiere, Mr. Harper.
Cool.
It's going to be Carl on January 10th at 7 p.m., and hopefully we'll get some of the filmmakers in here next time to talk about it. And today's been great. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you, listeners, for listening. And until next time.